will proceed to the fifth case, the Coons versus the United States. Ms. Lee.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Lee, and I represent the petitioner appellant in this case, Mr. Andrew Coons. Your Honors, this case raises the issue of whether Mr. Coons' trial counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to investigate the arrest of Mr. Coons and the search of his house in circumstances in which the police had no right to have been inside his house in the first place. The police lied that they had a warrant, drew their weapons, and then forced Mr. Coons to go back with them to his house. This case boils down to a situation where all of the evidence that was used to charge and convict Mr. Coons as a felon in possession was derived exclusively from an unconstitutional search and seizure. There are two reasons why this court should reverse the decision of the district court. First, Mr. Coons had meritorious Fourth Amendment claims. And second, his trial counsel's failure to raise those claims constituted ineffective assistance. Turning now to my first point, Mr. Coons suffered numerous Fourth Amendment violations. On April 19, 2007, police officers received a report about a possible stolen vehicle, and they went to Mr. Coons' house to investigate. Once there, they saw a vehicle parked outside on the driveway. The officers inspected the vehicle, investigated it, and determined that it was stolen. Now, at this point, before leaving his house, a neighbor from across the street approached the officers and stated in vague terms that he had participated in a firearms transaction with Mr. Coons some time ago. Hearing this single uncorroborated tip from this unidentified neighbor, the police then went to Mr. Coons' place of work. The police performed no additional investigation to corroborate this tip about the guns, but instead went to Decker Wrecker, where Mr. Coons was working. Now, once there, the police officers told Mr. Coons that they had a warrant, which was a lie, then drew their weapons upon him, and when Mr. Coons said that he did not want to go with the officers then made it clear to him that he was not permitted to refuse to comply and must instead go with them back to his house to open the door.
When did all this information come out that they forced him, etc.? That's pretty later on, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. The claims of Mr. Coons is spelled out in his Section 2255 habeas petition. However, Mr. Coons presented his trial counsel with evidence of a Fourth Amendment violation during the course of his criminal proceeding. This brings me to my second point.
Was he forced into not objecting to the pre-sentence report, for example? Why didn't he object at the pre-sentence report? All this was in it, saying that it was sort of voluntary and all that. Is that ineffective assistance, counsel?
Your Honor, Mr. Coons did not object to the factual events on that day during his plea hearing precisely because of his trial counsel's ineffectiveness. It is a reasonable inference that clients rely on their attorneys to advise them properly during the course of plea negotiations before advising their client to plead guilty. And Mr. Coons, in this case, relied on his trial counsel to tell him exactly how to plea.
No, you're saying that he told his counsel all these things that he's telling us later here. about the coercion and all that. He's saying now that's what he told his counsel, and his counsel, I don't know what told him back, and so he goes and doesn't object and pleads guilty and all that. He's saying his counsel knew the story we're hearing now.
Yes, that is Mr. Coons's claims, which in his habeas petition and in his sworn affidavit he alleges. It's a reasonable inference that Mr. Coons did present his trial counsel with evidence of the Fourth Amendment violations. And what's more, his trial counsel's affidavit, which the government relies on in its case, is utterly silent as to the fact that Mr. Coons did not bring this up with his trial counsel.
Hey, listen, at the plea hearing, the agent testified and said, I went to the place of employment, and Coons said, I know why you're here, it's about the guns. And at the plea hearing, Coons agreed that that's what happened. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So where are you going with a later claim that, oh, I was not telling the truth at the plea hearing when I agreed that the agent's story was correct? So after the fact, distancing himself from a statement he made in open court in front of a judge being sentenced. So where are you going with this?
Well, Your Honor, an omission during a plea hearing does not necessarily mean an admission. Mr. Coons
is... Oh, come on now. That's... Omission doesn't mean it. The agents testified how it all happened. It was... I went to his place of employment, and he said, oh, I know why you're here. It's about the guns. He took him over to the house. He gave him the guns. And that's what the agent testified to. And your client was asked by the judges, as they always do it. Now, you heard what the agent said. Is that what happened? And your client said, yes, it is.
Well, Agent Foreman, who did testify on the government's behalf, first of all, was not actually present on the day that the search and seizure took place. But what's important here is that Mr. Coons was told by his trial counsel to not object to the government's version of the events and to just plea out. Mr. Coons, his version of the facts, sworn to and attested to throughout his habeas petition, do spell out detailed, particularized facts that stand in stark contradiction with what this agent has claimed. And in a situation here where a habeas petitioner who wrote his petition pro se at that time and who had relied upon his trial counsel to give him good and reasonable advice about pleading deserves to have this evidentiary hearing on remand, particularly when he alleges that he did not consent, when he alleges that he did talk to his trial counsel who just dismissed him out of hand. When the record is sparse, Your Honors, with respect to what happened that day, and the record is sparse precisely because trial counsel didn't file a suppression motion. Trial counsel, his affidavit really is uninformative. It really is unhelpful. All his affidavit at paragraph 2 states is it was clear that Mr. Coons talked to the police and gave them the guns. Well, that may be true. We're not arguing that Mr. Coons did talk to the police and ended up turning over the guns to the police. But what's not clear from his attorney's affidavit, who is a formally trained attorney who presumably can write an affidavit, it does not state at all that his trial counsel fully investigated the facts of what happened that day and made a strategic decision or came to some sort of legal conclusion about the value and the merit of Mr. Coons' underlying claims. So here in a situation where we have a pro se Section 2255 petitioner who followed the advice of his counsel, didn't object to the government's version of the events during a plea, but who has maintained all along that there was no warrant for his arrest, that the police used a threat of force, and and that what transpired that day was anything but consensual, versus an affidavit written by a trial counsel that does not spell out that he fully did his job in investigating those claims and in determining that it was a strategic or a tactical decision to not file a motion.
Ms. Lee, in cases like this, sometimes we find infrequent contact between defense counsel and or alleged infrequent contact. Here, it's the position, at least the government says, he met with the defendant 17 times. Do you challenge that kind of contact, number of contacts?
No, Your Honor. The affidavit does state that he met with Mr. Coons 17 times.
Would you say that a counsel who invests that kind of time is the kind of counsel who would not exhaust a potential motion? I mean, you ask us to make some leap of faith on what the counsel did or didn't do and whether it's strategic or not, but that does seem like a high incidence of contact for a counsel who you suggest didn't exhaust every avenue.
Perhaps trial counsel did exhaust every legal avenue, but it's not clear here whether his trial counsel fully investigated whether or not there was consent, whether or not...
You're talking about the workplace encounter? When you talk about consent?
Correct.
They went to the workplace, and of course we have, as Judge Evans pointed out, the testimony of Agent Foreman of what occurred. We don't have anything countering that, obviously. You're suggesting we don't have that because the defendant's will in some way was overborne by a defense counsel saying you ought to plea. Is that what you're suggesting occurred here?
Yes, that's certainly a reasonable inference. And from the fact that trial counsel states that he met with his client 17 times, that really doesn't indicate to us that his trial counsel evaluated the claims and did what he was supposed to do. If Mr. Coons talked to his trial counsel about the fact that all of these violations occurred to him, then it was his lawyer's duty, it was his obligation to investigate those facts and to move to suppress. Otherwise, that would just be deficient performance.
And they would be moving to suppress exactly what? If such a motion, what would you be seeking to suppress in this case?
Not only the firearms, for the four that were seized within Mr. Coons' house, but Mr. Coons' statement that it's about the guns. And with the evidence of the firearms and the testimony of Mr. Coons thrown out, then the government could only proceed with a bare-bones tip from an across-the-street neighbor about a gun, which clearly would not have risen to the point of probable cause in order to charge, let alone convict, Mr. Coons as a felon.
Thank you, Ms. Lee.
Thank you.
Perez.
May it please the court. I'm Gerald Correz. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Southern District of Indiana representing the United States. I would like to bring to the court's attention a statement that Mr. Coons made to the district court judge at sentencing. And it's on page 32 of the sentencing transcript, starting at line 14. And it's, quote, "I knew I'd done wrong. I tried my best to clear it up by turning them over to the officers when they came, and they didn't have to get a warrant or anything like that." This is just one of the admissions of the truthfulness of the factual statement given by Special Agent Foreman at the change of plea hearing, but it is consistent with everything evidentiary-wise with respect to the plea of guilty on the part of Mr. Coons. Mr. Coons, when he saw the police officers, volunteered that he had firearms and offered to turn them over. He stated this to the officer at the scene. He acknowledged it when Special Agent Foreman gave his summation at the change of plea hearing. And he said it again to the judge before he was sentenced. He indicates he understood that a warrant might be needed. He didn't want to cause the officers to have to even do that. He knew he'd done wrong, and he was starting to do what he thought would mitigate a crime that he believed he'd been caught on. There is nothing in the record to indicate that any lies were made to Mr. Coons, that he was threatened in any way, that guns were drawn, or he was forced to allow officers into his home to retrieve weapons. With respect to ineffective assistance of counsel, Attorney Shaw says in his affidavit there is nothing in the case that indicates there's a suppression issue. He doesn't use that, but he does, I think it's in the second paragraph, say there's nothing in the case that indicates there's a defense of this nature, and that he was focusing on the armed career criminal aspect because that was a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence, and that was a great concern, as well as the fact that there were charges pending against Mr. Coons in Warrick County, Indiana, and in Vandenberg County, Indiana. If you go back to the transcript of the...
hoping that he's going to get some kind of consideration?
Well, not only is he hoping. If you go back to the guilty plea, Mr. Foreman is asked specifically, has the state agreed to dismiss if there's a guilty plea in the federal case? And he says, that's my understanding. That's also attested to in Mr. Shaw, that's the attorney's declaration or affidavit that he submitted. And, in fact, that did occur. Additionally, the sentence imposed on Mr. Coon was the statutory minimum sentence. Now, Mr. Coons argued against the armed career finding, and the judge carefully analyzed his argument. But simply on the law, it doesn't appear that there's a basis for averting that finding. So I think the district judge, Judge Young, was correct in finding the armed career finding. And then he sentenced him according to that. But what you see is counsel responding appropriately to what he has and the facts he has, not devising a defense that just doesn't have a basis in fact. And there's just nothing to indicate there's any basis in fact for the defense or the 2255 claim now asserted by Mr. Coon. There's one other aspect, and that is the Rule 11 plea proceeding and the seriousness of those proceedings. Criminal defendants can't believe that they can lie to a judge at a guilty plea and then come back on a 2255 and say, oh, it doesn't count, I want a new hearing. These proceedings are very solemn, and this court has recognized this in a number of cases. What a defendant says at a Rule 11 colloquy with the judge really matters. And if it matters so little that all a defendant has to do is make allegations without any support, corroboration, whatever, and he can undo his solemn representations to the court under oath at a Rule 11 proceeding, then there is really a serious problem with Rule 11 proceedings and guilty pleas. That's what turning this case around would really reflect. Mr. Coons made his representations to the court. He was not coerced. He made them continually. They are consistent throughout the proceedings. There's just no basis for 2255 relief. There's no basis for holding a hearing. Thank you, if there's no questions.
Thank you, Ms. Perez. Ms. Lee, your time had expired, but you may have 2 minutes.
Your Honor, the government mentions that trial counsel wrote, it is clear from the case that Mr. Coons suffered no violations. It is clear from what case? The affidavit by his attorney does not reveal that he did an adequate, reasonable job in fleshing out the facts underlying those Fourth Amendment claims. There is a basis in the record as we have it that Mr. Coons has maintained all along that he suffered these violations, not only in his sworn affidavit, but throughout his habeas petition, 40-some pages, allegations on pages 23, 24, 30, 32, 38, throughout his habeas petition, that he presented evidence of this defense, but that his trial counsel did not pursue it, and that trial counsel was clearly ineffective for investigating those, and that Mr. Coons would not have pleaded guilty but would have insisted on going to trial were it not for the advice of his counsel.
What does the record reflect anything about the educational background of the defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. In the plea, PSR, Mr. Coons has attained a middle school, high school level of education.
And is it? What else does it reflect about, if anything, about his contact with the criminal justice system?
I believe, Your Honor, that Mr. Coons has had some run-ins with law enforcement as a minor.
But no prior situations where a plea was involved. I'm just trying to see if there's a familiarity with the plea context. Because your suggestion, I believe it to be, that by the time we got to the plea and Agent Foreman's comments, he just was going to rotely agree as opposed to speak up and say, I've been telling my counsel all along that this isn't what happened.
Right. And while Mr. Coons has had a few run-ins with law enforcement as a minor, whether or not he entered into a plea in those situations is not indicative of whether or not he's going to follow his attorney's advice. Of course, he's going to follow that attorney's advice. And particularly in this case, if this court decides to remand back to the district court, there is no danger of an after-the-fact lie, as the government would have you believe. Because the record is so sparse, there was no motion filed, and that's precisely why an evidentiary hearing is needed to determine those facts. If there's a credibility issue, the district court would be in a position to determine what transpired.
Thank you, Ms. Lee.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. And Ms. Lee, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment.